This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. A federal appeals court has sided with the Mountain Valley Pipeline in an eminent domain lawsuit brought by landowners in the project's path. A panel of the 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed the ruling of a lower court judge who didn't rule in the case's constitutional issues but dismissed them, saying she lacked subject matter jurisdiction. Justin Luger, an attorney for the plaintiffs, said the clients are evaluating the opinion and possible next steps. A pipeline spokeswoman declined comment. Work on the natural gas pipeline is underway in West Virginia and Virginia. An executive with pipeline partner NextEra Energy said in an earnings call Wednesday that construction delays mean the project won't be in service until the first quarter of 2019 at the earliest. A committee investigating possible impeachment of one or more justices on the West Virginia Supreme Court of Appeals will return to Charleston for a third round of hearing evidence and testimony. As Dave Mistich reports, the proceedings come as one justice pleaded not guilty to additional federal charges.
The House Judiciary Committee is expected to hear testimony from former Supreme Court Administrator Steve Canterbury. During testimony last week, Deputy Director of Court Security Jess Gundy detailed a strained relationship between Canterbury and suspended Justice Alan Loffrey. Gundy said Canterbury threatened to go to the press when he was fired by Loffrey in January 2017. The committee has also issued a subpoena to Loffrey's wife, Kelly, to provide testimony on the moving of furniture from their family home. This includes a historic state-owned desk and a couch Loffrey claims was once the property of the late Justice Joe Albright. Loffrey cited a court policy saying justices could maintain a home office. Other witnesses have testified no such policy exists. On Wednesday, Loffrey pleaded not guilty to a federal obstruction of justice charge. Last month, he pleaded not guilty to 22 counts of fraud, witness tampering, and making false statements. These charges run separate from the ongoing proceedings on his possible impeachment. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Dave Mistich in Morgantown.
Higher education leaders in West Virginia announced yesterday a goal to see more of the state's workforce with a formal education credential beyond high school by 2030. Liz McCormick has more.
Leaders in higher education hope to see at least 60% of the state's workforce holding some kind of higher education credential in just a little more than 10 years. The West Virginia Higher Education Policy Commission made the announcement Wednesday in a press release. That means nearly doubling the percentage of working-age West Virginians who have either a traditional four-year degree or qualification, such as an associate's degree from a community college or some other kind of certification. This new campaign is called West Virginia's Climb. It was launched at the annual Student Success Summit this week, which attracts nearly 500 West Virginia educators and is sponsored by the West Virginia HEPC and the State Department of Education. Staff from the HEPC and the West Virginia Community and Technical College system acknowledge the campaign is a lofty goal, but one they say is attainable through awareness, college access, and dedication. According to the HEPC, the highest percentage by county of working-aged certificate and degree holders is Monongalia at 45%, while the lowest is McDowell at 8%. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Liz McCormick in Martinsburg.
Coal companies in central Appalachia have used mountaintop removal to mine coal for decades. The controversial process blows the tops off mountains to reach the coal seams below. Researchers and policymakers have struggled to understand the full extent of mountaintop removal across the region. Brittany Patterson reports on a new study that provides a big-picture view of the mining method's impact.
Turns out, if you want a clear picture of what is going on here on Earth, one place to look is to space. That's what researchers from Duke University and the nonprofits Sky Truth and Appalachian Voices did.
The primary imagery we used were from the Landsat satellites.
That's Andrew Parasek, a research analyst at Duke University and lead author of the new study. He says since the 1970s, Landsat satellites, which are operated by the U.S. Geological Survey and NASA, have been circling the globe, taking a photo of every location on Earth every 16 days. For years, researchers have known satellite imagery can be a great tool, but it requires a lot of computing power to process. Enter Google. The tech giant has uploaded a ton of satellite images into the cloud. Using Google's Earth Engine platform, Parasek and his team analyzed 10,000 Landsat images of central Appalachia between 1985 and 2015.
This isn't really something we'd be able to do before. If I tried to run this on my own computer, it would have literally taken probably years to process.
When taken together, the researchers were able to measure the full scope of mountaintop removal mining across the region.
About 3.5%, so about 2,900 square kilometers of our study area in central Appalachia has been directly impacted by surface mining.
Christian Thomas is a geospatial analyst with SkyTruth who worked on the project. He says adding the new findings to other work his organization did about earlier mining in the region reveals a total of some 1.5 million acres of disturbed land. Here's Parasek again.
That's about 2.8 times the size of Great Smoky Mountains National Park. So it's a really big area that even I still have sometimes like wrapping my head around just how big of an area that is.
Or put another way, the total affected mine lands are roughly equal in size to the state of Delaware. The researchers say this tool, which is free and available to the public and other developers, can be used by scientists, nonprofits, and even local or state governments to dig into how mountaintop mining may be affecting people and the environment nearby. And while the goal of the project wasn't to analyze if and how mountaintop removal has changed over the last 30 years, the researchers wanted to give an example of how the new data could be useful. They compared how much land was mined to how much coal was being produced on a year-by-year basis. From 1985 to 2005, the researchers found it took about 10 square meters of land to produce 1 metric ton of coal. By 2015, the amount of land needed to get the same amount of coal had tripled.
We think it's a really strong way to demonstrate that even though we're really just presenting these maps, they can be tied to a lot of different spatial or a lot of different data sets to reach some new and interesting findings.
The study was published Wednesday in the open source journal PLOS One. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Brittany Patterson.
The Ohio Valley Resource is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. It's 7:51. Areas of dense fog this morning, becoming mostly sunny today, highs in the 80s. A slight chance of rain and thunderstorms tonight with lows in the 60s. Tomorrow, partly cloudy skies, a slight chance of rain and thunderstorms, highs in the 80s. Support for West Virginia Public Broadcasting is provided by Lumos Networks, providing next-generation communication solutions over an expanding fiber optics network. More information at lumosnetworks.com. In a hospital, do not resuscitate means staff aren't supposed to give CPR if a patient's heart stops. It's an order doctors put into a patient's chart at the request of the patient. But these DNR orders can result in unintended consequences, the withholding of treatment before death. As WFPL's Lisa Gillespie reports, the misunderstanding is common in hospitals, both in Kentucky and around the country.
For Kathy Roden-Gogan, her first experience with Do Not Resuscitate or DNR orders came last year, 2 days after her father was admitted to Baptist Health Corbin with abdominal pain.
I was asleep. We had left the hospital about 9 the night before. So a little after 5, close to 5:30, my cell phone rang.
It was a nurse who told Roden-Gogan her father's heart rate was dropping.
So I asked her, has he been moved to ICU? And she said that he had a DNR, so they couldn't move him to ICU.
13 minutes later, before she could get to the hospital, Robert Roden's heart stopped.
It was terrible to have no goodbye.
Roden had a DNR, according to public records obtained from the Kentucky Cabinet for Health and Family Services. But his medical records show he had also requested some other treatment, like drugs that work to increase heart rate and a machine that works to restore breathing. Records show he didn't get that treatment before he died. And according to experts, confusion among hospital workers about what a DNR order actually means isn't uncommon.
DNR stands for Do Not Resuscitate and is what we call a code status order that refers to whether we attempt to perform CPR in the event that a patient's heart stops. DNR does not mean do not treat.
That was Sarah Rosenthal, the chair of the Ethics Committee at the University of Kentucky Hospital. Technically, DNR orders apply when a patient's heart stops. If the patient has a DNR, they've made it known they don't want CPR to restart their heart. But studies have shown DNR orders often wrongly affect the care patients receive before they die. Hospital staff either think a DNR order means they shouldn't give a patient treatment before death, or they assume a patient doesn't want treatment. Maxwell Virgo is a doctor at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center in New Hampshire. He says hospital staff misunderstanding DNR orders is a nationwide issue, even at Dartmouth.
We've done surveys here that show that a DNR patient, everyone likes to extrapolate that out to before you're found dead, if you're DNR, they tend not to do other stuff because they kind of think that you're someone who wants less rather than more.
A 2008 study from Boston University found that patients with heart failure were much less likely to receive certain treatments if they had a DNR order. Virgo at Dartmouth says the problem often boils down to how a doctor interprets the patient's wishes, laid out in an electronic health record. These are called code status orders.
People use the code status order as like a catch-all for goals of care. You know, like, tell me all the life support you do and don't want, no matter whether your heart's beating or not. Those two patient groups are different, people who have died and people who are getting sicker.
To try to cut through the confusion, several states, including Kentucky, have adopted a new kind of form to try to make patients' desires clearer. It's called a Medical Orders for Scope of Treatment form, or MOST for short. It sets out whether a patient wants a DNR order if their heart stops. Then it moves on to what treatment the patient wants if they still have a pulse or are breathing. But Rosenthal with UK says not all hospitals in the state are using the form.
It's a relatively new form and it just requires more education. Basically, we need to just educate healthcare providers on the purpose of the form and the limitations of the form and how to use them.
Dartmouth is doing something about the confusion among their staff. They're making it a little easier to integrate their version of the MOST form into an electronic health record.
So I think our fix might for right now be a code status button that you can click and see, but that it'll have those two different categories in it, and that the providers will be trained to look at the patient and figure out which category they fit in, and then use the orders under that category to decide what may be reasonable to do.
That more clear-cut coding system might have helped Rodin Gogan's dad. After his death, Rodin Gogan contacted a patient advocate who filed a complaint with the state. The federal government examined the case, and the inspection found several instances where it seemed health workers were confused about Robert Rodin's care, or in one case, even his identity. They called his family a day before he died to tell them Rodin had passed away, when in fact, he was alive. But the inspector also found that Baptist Health Corbin didn't have a clear policy about when staff were expected to perform CPR. In a statement, Baptist Health Corbin says the hospital takes patients' end-of-life care decisions seriously. Rodin Gogan says she's going to work in Frankfurt to push for a more uniform way of displaying patients' DNR codes and desired treatment. In the meanwhile, she's being proactive. She recently did a version of the MOST form in video format with her primary care doctor, with the hope that if she's ever in the position her father was, her wishes will be more clear to hospital staff.
What does DNR mean to you? That was one of the questions. And I said, well, I'm confused on what it means, because to me, it means if my heart stops beating, you will not resuscitate me. But when my father was still breathing and still had a pulse, it meant he was not treated. So the doctor said to me, you're not the one that's confused. It's the hospital that's confused.
I'm Lisa Gillespie in Louisville.
West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Our producer is Glenys Board. I'm Teresa Wills.